rolling.
Well, we'd like to welcome you all back, and welcome whoever's here, if you wasn't here last night, but thank you all very much for coming. As you know, I'm Marie, and this is Victoria. I think everyone knows that, and we're part of Heart of Wisdom Melbourne. And I'd just really like to express my gratitude to everyone who comes and helps set up and does everything, and also to my boys who've helped with the advertising and the website and everything else. So thank you very much on behalf of Heart of Wisdom Melbourne. And as I said last night, Heart of Wisdom Melbourne is a middleway centre, and its aim is to bring the teachings to us in practical ways so that we can live more meaningful lives. And this is the second of the talks today on the Heart Sutra. We had the first one yesterday, and we've got another one following later this afternoon. So there's a break. This talk goes to 2:30, and then there's a break till 4, and so we come back from 4 to 6 to have the third one, and then the final one is tomorrow from 4 to 6. And as I mentioned, yesterday we have a retreat coming up at the ashram, and also a talk by Cindy Lee at our house on Tuesday at 7 o'clock, and another talk for the under 25s.
Monday.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, yes, on Monday for the under 25s at from 5 to 6. And so I'd like to introduce Lama Marut to you. I'm sure you all know him, so I won't go into the detail I did last night, but as we know, he comes to us with a wealth of experience about all sorts of things, and his teachings, especially he's a master teacher of emptiness, and so it's just wonderful to have him here to, you know, to help us with the Heart Sutra and to make that really accessible to us. So I'd like to thank you so much for coming to teach us, Lama Marut.
Okay, so I think most of you were here last night, but one or two are coming for the first time, and that's fine. You can drop into these classes. Hopefully, you'll get something out of each one. Each one stands alone, but of course, they all fit together because we want to try to get through the whole sutra. This is a four-class course on the Heart Sutra, which is probably, as I said last night, probably the most famous Mahayana Buddhist text in the world. Buddhism is broadly divided into Theravada and Mahayana, and Heart Sutra's got to be up there as, you know, one of the most well-known and popular, although not very well understood text. It's a very, you know, it's very enigmatic, and requires education, requires people like us, you know, who have had the fortune of being educated extensively and learning how to think and learning how to understand things, and not just go through it by rote, you know, like it usually has been done in the traditions of Buddhism in Asia, just memorized and recited, which is thought to have its own power, actually. So the text is kind of like has been used traditionally as a kind of an amulet, you know, kind of like a magical power in and of itself. And even today, if you go to a Dalai Lama teaching, for example, oftentimes he'll have a whole like half an hour of different different monks and nuns from different traditions just recite the Heart Sutra in their own language, and you know, just chanting it like that. So we're fortunate to be able to, you know, to actually analyze it and try to figure it out, try to understand what it's talking about. Yeah, Malcolm.
How long is the text?
Well, there's different versions of it. So, you know, what I've given you here is sort of the longest of the Heart Sutras, the most complete, because it's got a prologue, it's got a setup, it's got, you know, all of that kind of bells and whistles. But actually, in some recensions and the way it's sometimes memorized and recited, it would start, a little bit later. None of the prologue, none of the setup.
Because they have this idea that, you know, certain Muslims recite the Quran and they know it.
Yep.
Beginning to end.
Yep.
It's a bit of work.
I'm just
wondering what this is like.
No, the Heart Sutra is relatively easy. I mean, you know, I tried to memorize it. on a retreat one time. I got through about half of it, and now I've forgotten it all. You know. But it, you know, you can memorize it. It's not that difficult. It's not that long. In fact, that's why it's called Heart. One of the reasons why it's called Heart Sutra is because it's condensed. So we talked a little bit. One of the subtitle of the whole course is called Finding the Heart in the Heart Sutra. So, you know, last night we talked a little bit about, well, what does that mean? You know, what is the heart of the Heart Sutra? And so we gave, you know, there's a number of possibilities. First of all, it's called the Heart Sutra because it's supposed to be the condensation of texts much longer. So in the Buddhist tradition, in the Prajnaparamita, you know, kind of tradition of texts, perfection of wisdom texts, there are Prajnaparamita texts that are 100,000 verses. And that would take some time to memorize. Yeah. So this is supposed to be the Reader's Digest version, you know, cliff notes to Prajnaparamita, and that's one of the reasons why they call it the Heart Sutra. It's also interesting. It's not called the Mind Sutra, you know. It's not called the Intellect Sutra. It's called the Heart Sutra, Hridaya, and it's spoken by Avalokiteshvara, who's joined me up here today in image form, who is, like I said last night, the sort of bodhisattva, the saint of compassion. So it's an interesting kind of a combination of being a text that purports to be from the heart, you know, heartfelt. Yeah? Hridaya, heartfelt. And spoken by Mr. Heart right here, you know. Taught by Avalokiteshvara, but it's all about wisdom, which is kind of important, I think. You know, it's an important symbolic juxtaposition, which suggests that to have true compassion, we must have wisdom. It's not good enough just to feel, you know, compassion and a sense of love and something like that. We have to understand why. You know, if you've if you've taken a spiritual training to heart, so to speak, and, you know, I've actually tried to be nice to other people, you know, as a kind of a spiritual practice, you've maybe run into difficulties, you know? Like, my experience of it, you know, is just like, well, okay, you know, I've tried to be nice. And it lasts for about an hour. Maybe two, three, before the third irritating person of the day, you know, confronts you. The first one is like, yes, I'm being nice and blah, blah, blah. The second one is, well, okay, I'll be nice. And by the third one, it's just like, well, hell with this. You know, they've pushed me too far now. Right? It's too difficult. if it's just on sentiment, if it's just based on, you know, good feelings, good vibes, I want to try to be nice. It's thin. It's, you know, the ice is very thin. So the wisdom part gives us a reason to keep going at it. Why should I be nice, you see? Why should I try to be a better person in life when there's so many challenges, right? And so the wisdom part of the Heart Sutra is to understand how things exist and how they don't exist. And to understand that gives us the ammunition, gives us the depth to keep going when it isn't just easy. When it's not like people, you know, being nice back when you're nice to them, you see. You don't get any extra credit for that, okay? You know, when people are nice to you, you're nice to them and they're nice back, you know, no gold star on your chart, okay? That's just like, you know, ordinary human intercourse, you know? It's just like, you know, society. That's how societies are formed. You know, people are nice to each other and interact nicely, okay? No spiritual, you know, merit much in that, you know? It's when you're compassionate, when you're tolerant, when you're patient, even when it's not easy, especially when it's not easy. And that's where the wisdom comes in. Why should I? And the answer, the short answer, the, you know, when it comes to wisdom, is because we all exist interdependently. None of us exist independently. And so that gives us some rationale. That gives us some reason for why we should maintain the kind of, you know, compassionate, forgiving, you know, tolerant sort of attitude. Because if we do, then the people that we're interacting with will seem different to us, you see? Because none of us is alone. The irritating person is irritating when we are irritated. But they can't be irritating if we are not irritated. That's dependence. That's interdependence, right? We usually don't get irritated for no reason. Okay? So we confront a person or a situation and it seems irritating. It seems, you know, challenging in some way or another. Right? But then we have to play our role too. You see, that's interdependence. There has to be this kind of, you know, relationship. You wouldn't get irritated at something, usually, at something that's not irritating. But you wouldn't be irritated unless it were irritating. You see what I mean? So that's interdependence. That's a kind of a reflection. It's a relationship, and everything is in relationships like that. So here's the good news, okay? If you change one, you change them both. Because they exist interdependently, if you change one, you change them both. So let's deal with the irritating person. How could I stop being irritated by an irritating person? Well, I could change the irritating person. I could try to change them and make them less irritating. How's that worked out so far? I mean, this is our usual modus operandi, is to say, well, you know, you should really be nicer to me. You know, I'm having difficulty with this relationship. I'd like to be open and honest with you about how difficult you are for me. And you know, would you please stop being so difficult? And then, like, you know, you wait around for them to stop being difficult so that you're not irritated. If they're not difficult, if not irritating, then you wouldn't be irritated. So you could try it that way. I think we've all tried it that way. Not just once, but many times. And on a kind of a daily basis. Or what? Change you. Stop being irritated. And then presto change-o. You know? Kazam, is it? Shazam. Shazam, the magic. All of a sudden, there's not an irritating person there. Because you're not irritated. Okay? That's the good news about how things do exist. They exist interdependently, not independently. Independently means there's you and the irritating person, and then you just happen to run into each other. You see? Right? The irritating person is irritating because you are irritated. And they are not on their own irritating. And that's the case with everything. So that's one of the main teachings of the Heart Sutra. That's wisdom. And things are empty of existing in any other way than that. And that's what emptiness means. Okay? So it's, you know, well, I've been studying, you know, this theory. You know, emptiness is one of the great contributions, philosophical contributions of Mahayana Buddhism to world philosophy and religion. You know, the Shunyata. It's a very famous. The Western philosophers don't quite know what to do with it. You know, Nagarjuna was the great proponent, philosophical proponent of emptiness, the philosophy of emptiness. And he's recognized worldwide, you know, as a philosopher, but they don't know where to put him. They don't know how to categorize him because he doesn't stand for anything. He has no doctrine. He has no thesis. He just says no to everything. It's the great negation. No. Nothing has any self-existence. Nothing exists on its own. Everything exists interdependently. Nothing exists independently. And that's the whole emptiness teaching right there. That's wisdom. And so the way to get at that, the way to get a heart experience of that, okay, to have it be heartfelt, Hridaya Sutra, right? To have it be heartfelt isn't intellectual, really. Intellectually, I just summed up the whole of, emptiness theory in like two sentences. You can do it. Everything exists interdependently. Nothing exists in any other way than that. It's empty. But intellectually is one thing. Feeling that and living your life that way, that's the real heart of the Heart Sutra. That's what they're trying. That's the heart they're pointing. That's the moon that this text is a finger pointing to. Try to get that experience. That experience of interbeing. That we're not alone. None of us is alone. None of us is independent of any one of us, of any other of us, you see, and with the world around us. In Western philosophy, or recent Western philosophy, the Descartesian formulation was really, really influential. I think, therefore I am, right? Cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. This is refuted by a text like this, okay? I am because you are. It's not I think. It's not all going on in here, you see. It's not all just like sort of separated out from the interactions that we have with others. Who's the I that thinks? I think, therefore I am. Well, it's a thinker I that exists only in relation to the thought that the thinker thinks. You see? It's not a separate, independent, isolated I that then thinks. This is the big fallacy. I think, therefore I am. I can't be a thinker unless there's a thought that I'm thinking. The thought and the thinker come into existence simultaneously, interdependently. There's no thinker waiting to think a thought. It's to be a thoughtless thinker. No, literally. I'm a thinker. I'm not thinking anything. Soon I will think, I think, then, cogito, I think. Who's the I that thinks? Unless there's a thought thunk. You see what I mean? That's interdependence. And we'll go into that in today's class, actually. The sutra goes into exactly that kind of thing. There's no seer without something seen, a visible object. You can't be a seer not seeing something. So the seer comes into existence with the existence of the visible object and vice versa. There's no visible object without a seer. There's potentially visible objects, okay, right? But they're not visible until they're seen, right? If there was an independent visible object, it would have the capability to be visible and invisible at the same time. If it were independently existing, out there on its own, standing by itself as a visible object, it could exist as a visible object when no one sees it, which means invisible. Isn't that what it means? No one sees it means invisible. So it would be an invisible, visible object. Do we believe in like things like this? All the time. All the time. My favorite example of this is like, if we all left the room, would this glass still be a visible object? If all of us seers who are now seeing this glass all left the room, would the glass exist as a visible object? And if you say yes to that, that means it's an invisible, visible object. It's a visible object that is not being seen by anyone. The visible object is visible because it's seen. And the seer of visible objects is a seer because the seer sees a visible object. And that's how things exist. And they are empty of existing in any other way than that. And it's not just seeing. Hearing, smelling. There's no smell that isn't smelt. There's no smell that's just sitting there, I'm a smell. Right? The smell has to be smelt by a smeller to be a smell. Isn't it? Yeah. And there's no smeller who doesn't smell something. Right? A smeller who is a smeller who's not smelling anything would be a smeller who is independent of the smell that they smell. You see what I mean? Just work it through all the senses. Same. There's no sound. So now you remember that like famous koan, right? If a tree fell in the forest and no one was there to hear it, did it make a sound?
Of course not. If it made a sound with no hearer to hear the sound, that would be an independently existing sound. In other words, it would be an inaudible sound. You see what I mean? Because there's nobody there to hear it. Inaudible, that's what inaudible means, isn't it? Nobody heard it. So how can there be an inaudible sound? See, contradiction in terms, right? Logical contradiction. So if the tree fell in the forest and no one was there to hear it, did it make a sound? Of course not. There has to be a hearer for there to be a sound heard, right? And the hearer exists because they hear a sound. Both. So this is the heart of the Heart Sutra in a way, you could say. Okay. This is truth. This is how things exist. And they do not exist in any other way than that. So in today's classes, we're going to go through the great negation. The Heart Sutra is very famous for this. There is no nose. There is no eye. There is no ear. There is no... You go through a whole big list. And one of the things he's doing in the list, whoever's wrote this text, right, which is kind of an interesting question we went through last night a little bit. Whoever's speaking this, evam maya shrutam. Here's what I heard. I don't know, like, who the hell... I don't know... We don't know who it was that heard it, and we don't know who it was that said it. It's just transmitted. It's kind of free-floating. It's anonymous, which is kind of cool. It's like nobody's project, you see? It's nobody's, you know, work. Nobody's, I thought of the Heart Sutra, you see? It's just, you know, it's the way it is. Doesn't matter who said it. Doesn't matter who thought it, who originally, you know, wrote it or something like that. It's a transcription of the way things are. There is no nose in the sense of the faculty of smell without a smell that the faculty smells. That's what there is no nose means. It's not that you don't have a nose. You know, if it were like, and sometimes it's kind of like read that way. It's like, well, maybe my nose is an illusion. You see, maybe I don't really have a nose. Like it's like somehow put my hand through the nose, like it's like some vapor or something. You see? Not like that. Of course you got a nose. Of course you got an eye. Of course you are a seer, a smeller, a feeler, a taster. What am I missing?
A toucher,
and a thinker. But not until you have an object that goes with each one of those senses. Okay? And the object of each one of those senses, visible things, audible things, tangible things, etc., smelly things, only exist interdependently with the smeller, the hearer, the seer, and so forth. Nothing exists on its own. Everything exists in relationship. And that's the way it is. Okay? That's not really disputable. Nagarjuna was like, you know, we're not doing a Nagarjuna text, but he was sort of like the Muhammad Ali of philosophy. He did this kind of rope-a-dope thing. Remember Muhammad Ali was just like, he'd just like bounce around off the ropes and said, go ahead, try and hit me. Go ahead, you know. And just wear his opponent down as they tried to get at him, you know. And the Nagarjuna is the same way. It's just like, go ahead. Bring me something that exists independently. Go ahead. I say everything is empty of existing independently. So you go ahead. Show me something that exists independently. It's impossible to refute. You see, impossible. There's nothing that exists independently. If there was something, he says in Nagarjuna, if there was something, if there was one thing that existed independently, then we could say the whole theory of emptiness is false. The whole idea of emptiness would be false. But because there's no one thing that exists independently, anything, everything is empty. You see? Because there's nothing that exists on its own without being in a relationship, everything is empty. And that's the heart. That's the heart of the Heart Sutra. And to take that to heart would result in a rather different kind of a life. You see? We wouldn't live the same way. If it weren't just a mental thing but became a heart thing. You know? If it worked on the hard disk. You know? If it rewired the hard disk, we would go through life very, very different. Because we would understand that we play a crucial role in our existence, in every form of our existence. We are a crucial player. We're not just a passive victim, you see. Not just like passively receiving stuff from the outside world, which is out there on its own coming at me. It's coming both at you and from you. Has to be, okay? That's interdependence. Okay? It's not all coming from you either. That would be a mistake. That's a mistake of speech. To say, everything's coming from me, I'm creating my whole world, etc., etc. Who's the I that's creating the whole world? You see? If you put it that way, and if you think about it that way, then you're assuming an independent subject who then creates the world, you see? Projects the world. It's in relationship. The subject is in relationship to the object, and the object is in relationship to the subject. And neither one can exist without the other. Okay? There's no perceiver without something perceived. There's nothing perceived without a perceiver perceiving it. Okay? Nothing seen without something seer. No seer either without something seen. So it's not that we're all just projecting our reality. Okay? It's in a mutual... Our reality is projecting us too. You could put it like that. Okay? The world around us is projecting us just as we are projecting the world around us. And neither one can come first. Neither one can exist independently of the other. And that's awesome, you see? That's potentially, hair-raising? You know, little hairs in the back of your neck. You know, if you get some whiff of the truth of that, you know, then you go, well, wait. I could change anything, you see. If I changed me, if I changed one half of the relationship, then the other half of the relationship would have to change too. And so instead of working it ass backwards, which is how we're usually doing it. I'm going to change the world so I'll feel better, right? If I change the irritating person, if I, you know, make more money, if I have a better job, if I have more holiday time, then I'll be happy. Or you can just be happy. You see? No, I mean, if we're trying to change the outer, the external, the objects, so that the subject will change, right? So I'll feel happier. And so we try. We try our whole lives, you see. Our whole lives are working the equation backwards. It's true that if you change the object, you'll change the subject. But it's a lot harder. Have you noticed? It's a lot harder. So, you know, one way to think about this is like, you know, let's take the money example. I will be happy if I had more money. I'd be happy if I were more prosperous. So we work hard, we save our money, or if you believe in karma, you start saying things like, well, I'm going to create the karma for more money, which usually means I'm being generous so that like in those cartoons where bags of cash come flying in and landing in your front your lounge room, I've been generous and so the money should come, yeah, working the karmic system. This is the same principle. It's just a spiritualized version of what anyone does. I'll work harder at work, and I'll get another second job, so that the money will come. You see, so I'll be prosperous. That's one way. Those are equally ways of trying to change the outside, the object, so that you will change, so that you'll feel I have enough money. I'm prosperous now. Or you can change the subject. Which is what? I'm content with the money I have. I'm content with my level of prosperity now. And then guess what? You will find that you have enough money because you're content with the money that you have. You see? You've changed the object by changing the subject. You've changed the perception of the object by changing the subject. You can change the perception of the subject by changing the object. That's what we're all trying to do our whole lives. But it's much easier, quicker, and more surefire to change the subject. You see? To change the subject. It's not, you know, take the money example. Money example is very pertinent. We're all like influenced by this, right? You know, I thought, if only I had a little more money. You see, you know. Wendy Lee's got a joke about houses. She says, houses are always within $50,000 of being perfect. You know, if only $50,000 more reno, then my house would be finally perfect. And as soon as you get to that level, of course, then it's another $50,000. You know, well, yeah, but bathroom needs doing also, you know, and, right? And so we try to, you know, this is the cycle of suffering due to discontent. Perpetual discontentment with the world around us. And so that's not going to solve the problem, really. You see? It potentially could. You know, potentially, if you really believed that another $50,000 of reno on your house would finally make your house perfect, then you could, like, invest $50,000 into the house, and then you'd be happy with your house. But chances are pretty good that that's not how it's working in your life or in any one of our lives, right? You get to that level, and then it's like, no, but wait, you know, if only I had another $50,000. Is that the case with income? It's the case with everything, right? As soon as we get to what outside, we think would make us happy, it turns out not to satisfy. Then we want more. You see, something else. There's only one thing worse than not getting what you want. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Well, I got it, but oh, this isn't exactly what I thought it would be. This isn't, right? You just can't get no. And I try and I try and I try. I can't get no. Or, so that's working it from the outside. Things exist interdependently. Okay? So you get another $50,000 reno on your house, you'll have a different sort of feeling about your house. But will it be a feeling of contentment? Or will it just stimulate another motive for another $50,000 investment to fix up that other part, you see? That's how we live. That's how it goes over and over again. So you can try it that way. You can try to change the object, and with the change of the object, you will change the subject. With the change of the outside world, you will change the inside world. Or you can do it in the more surefire way, which is to change the inside world. And then the outside world looks fine, you see? Then the outside world changes. If you're content, then life will look good, you see? If you're content, your life will look good automatically. If you're content subjectively, if you're content with your life, then everything in it, $50,000 reno or not, will look fine. House is fine. See? Not because the house changed. And not because of people changing either. See, sometimes people, most of the time, not sometimes, all the time, we want to try to change other people. Right? How's that going? That enterprise of changing other people, trying to make them, you know, according to your will. You see? If only they were this or that, then I'd have a nice relationship with them. If only they were, you know, more patient, or if only they were different, you see. And then we try over and over again to change others. And if they became more patient and more different out there, then you would have a different subjective view of the relationship. That's true. Or you could just do it quick and easy and change your own subjective view of that relationship. And then presto changes, see? No worries. This is the beauty of interdependence. You know, it's worth spending some time with, okay? Because the text, you know, it's heavy going. It's, you know, it's recondite. It's kind of mysterious and all like that. But this is what it's teaching. Things are empty. That means that things exist only interdependently, okay? You can't even say dependently. Because dependently means that something depends on something else that's already there. Doesn't it? something, if something, we say something exists dependently on something, it means the on something that the thing is dependent on is already there. So a visible object exists dependently on a seer, which is half true. You see what I mean? Half true. Because the seer exists dependently on the visible object also. That's why I prefer interdependence, because it avoids this mistake. The mistake comes in two forms. The mistake comes in the idea that everything is out there coming at me. Things exist independently out there, and then I experience them. Visible things, audible things, etc. Perceptual things, etc. Okay? Or it comes in the form, this is kind of the New Agey, you know, philosophy light form, L-I-T-E. Everything's coming from me. Everything's just projected by me. I'm creating my world, you see, which assumes that there's a you that then creates a world. You see what I mean? That the world exists dependently on you. And that's not true either. That's only half true, you could say. That's half true. You see? See the difference? The world isn't out there coming at us, and the world isn't in here coming from us. It is mutual. It is reflective. It is, what do you call it, symbiotic. And neither one can come first. No subject without an object, no object without a subject. And neither object or subject unless there's an interaction between them. So there's no seer without a visible object, and there's no visible object without a seer. Okay? Yeah? And there's no seer or visible object unless there's seeing. Present participles. You see? A relationship between them. So it's all relational. Everything exists relationally. Everything exists interdependently, interbeing. Everything is in relation to something else. And nothing exists independent of that. Including, I got to get to the text here pretty soon. Including, okay, for the Buddha heads in the room, emptiness itself. Emptiness is not independent. Okay? Not free-floating emptiness. Okay? Emptiness exists in relation to something that is empty. And only. Okay? So first there has to be something that is empty for there to be emptiness. Emptiness can't exist without something which is empty. Even at the sort of deepest level of philosophy, nothing exists independently. Everything exists interdependently, including emptiness and the world of form, the world of appearances. There is no emptiness without the world of appearances. And of course, there's no world of appearances as they exist interdependently with each other. There's no world of appearances that exists without emptiness. Because that's what interdependence means. Interdependence means that things are empty of existing how? Come on, you got it now. Come on. Independently. Self-existently, sometimes they say. Self-existently means all by itself out there. Doesn't need anybody. Doesn't need anything. All right. So that's the Heart of the Heart Sutra, really. Shall we keep going? We got to the question, right? The two main protagonists, there's three protagonists in this text. There's the Buddha. And we went into the question last night about, well, who is the Buddha? You know? The Buddha in this text is kind of a placeholder. He's kind of just behind the scenes, you could say. He's not on stage, really. But he inspires the conversation, the question and the answer that the text actually, you know, is composed about, around. Okay? Which, as I mentioned last night, this is one of the beautiful things about this text, is that it suggests to us that not just the answers are inspired by the divine, if you want to call it that, by the Buddha, but the questions too. The questions that we ask of life, the questions that come to our minds about, you know, what the point of life is, the deep questions, are also inspired by the divine. So inspired by the Buddha, Shariputra asks Avalokiteshvara a question. Shariputra is he's called here a junior monk. Actually, the translation that I did for the word is venerable, which means old, doesn't it? Venerable means old. And that's what the Sanskrit means. Ayushman. Ayushman means somebody who's lived a long life. Ayush means like as in Ayurveda. So somebody who possesses a lot of life. It's a kind of a term of respect for a young person that an old person would use. Old person would say, oh, you're so venerable. You 18-year-old kid. Or something like that, right? You see what I mean? So Shariputra, the sort of junior monk here, the new kid on the block, asks the question of Avalokiteshvara, the one who has loving eyes, and inspired by the Buddha, they have a conversation. What's the question? The question is, if I have realized that a life of ignorance, a life of deception, of self-deception, a life of just following my, unrestrained and uneducated desires, if I've realized that that isn't the way to live a satisfying life, how should I live? So remember, one of the things that this text is also doing, is encoded in the text, is the five, what they call paths, the five pathways. And this question indicates that Shariputra has had some new pathways open up in his brain. He's reached the path of what they call accumulation. First path, accumulation. They call it accumulation because it's at this point that you really start accumulating some momentum spiritually. And not really until you have gotten some version of, what they usually call renunciation. I always try to avoid the word because people get the willies when they hear the word renunciation. So, oh my God, I'm going to have to give up good stuff. And nobody wants to give up good stuff. Nobody wants to give up the things that make you happy. And that's not what renunciation means. Renunciation means I'm renouncing the things that make me unhappy, including ignorance. Ignorance is not bliss. Wisdom is bliss. Okay? And we all want bliss. We all want to be happy. We want to live a blissful life. But we can't do it deluded. We can't do it ignorantly. We can't do it thinking that things exist in impossible ways. And then chasing them, you see? So, how does this work in real life? Say that you like lattes. I like lattes. And so we say, well, if I had a latte, I'd be happy. So we get a latte and it tastes good. It brings us a little spike of pleasure because, lattes are good if you like lattes. There are people who don't like lattes, which proves what? That the likability isn't in the latte. You see? And that's ignorance. The ignorance is thinking, well, if I only had like an endless supply of lattes, then I could maintain happiness in life. Because lattes are happiness producing. Yeah? That's mistaking something that exists interdependently for something that exists, that's mistaking something that does exist interdependently for something that we think exists independently. You see? So we're trying to wire up our lives so that everything in it will just continue to bring us a source of pleasure. Because we think, well, if it's all out there, if it's the lattes, if it's the, nice ethnic meals, it's the holidays, it's nice relationship with my ideal mate, if I could get all of those sort of balls up in the air, juggling all those balls, get them all up in the air at the same time, then I'd be happy. That's ignorance. It's never going to work out. Okay? There's always some ball that's falling. Okay? No, you get the foodie culture ball up in the air, and then the relationship ball thing falls down. And then you get the relationship thing, and then the work thing falls down. you're never going to be able to micromanage the external world in such a way that you're never unhappy. See, that's ignorance. That's thinking it's coming at me. All these things that are happiness producing are going to come at me somehow. So once you realize that, that things do not exist independently but exist interdependently. Then he says, well, now, where do I go from here? I'm renouncing the idea. Okay, here's what you're really renouncing. I'm renouncing the idea that happiness can come from anywhere else but myself. It's not out there. It's not in other people. You know, it's not in other things. Other people and other things cannot make you happy. See, renunciation is getting some small, at least, you know, recognition of that. And then you're ready for a spiritual life, you see. A truly spiritual life, no matter what you call it, Buddhism, Christianity, Hinduism, New Age religion, whatever you call it, isn't about changing the external world. It's about changing you. Okay? That's why they call it spiritual. Spiritual. It's about the spirit, your spirit. It isn't about the irritating person's spirit. I'm working on my spiritual life, trying to change the spirit of my irritating person. You see? Or trying to change the, you know, amount of income that's coming in, or the holidays that I have, making them better. I'll create the karma to have a better holiday. That Bali holiday didn't work out. You know, I'm going to go to Phuket next time, have a better, you know. The spiritual life isn't about that. It's about changing you. It's about changing your spirit. And so once you realize that the happiness isn't out there coming at you, then you will, I want happiness, and so I'll start a spiritual life, working on me, working on the hard drive that's internal. And that's the path of accumulation. Then there's momentum, you see. Then you stop fantasizing and diverting a lot of resources, you know, mental resources and other kinds of resources, to trying to fix, micromanage the world out there. Then you start working on the world in here, and the more you work on the world in here, the better the world out there looks. And that's the secret of life. That's the secret of happiness. See? It's no secret to say, well, if I had $100 million or something like that, then I'd be, you know, I'd have more resources, I'd have more prosperity, see. It's no secret that, you know, in the idea that if the external world were better, then I'd be happier, you see. That's not a secret at all. That's the open, you know, kind of strategy that we're all following in life. The secret is, if you change you, you change the world. You know, we're trying to change the world in order to change us into a happier person. We'll change the world, change all those irritating people, you know, and then I'll be happy. Change the world, and that's true. Change the world, and you'll change you. Or you can change you, and you will change the world, because things exist interdependently and not independently. Yeah, yeah? So let's go. Let's start the class, actually. Aviloketeshvara, you know, Shariputra says, if any son of a good lineage, this is at the end of the first class, right? If any son of a good lineage, somebody who's like joined the family of spiritual practitioners, okay? You know, the Dalai Lama once was asked, he was once accused of, like, you know, You're supposed to be a leader of a major world religion, Tibetan Buddhism, and religions have just caused nothing but trouble throughout the history of, you know, humankind, which is true. You know the history of religions is one long saga of bloodshed, strife, warfare, and, you know, nastiness. It's true. So the kid had a point. The person had a point. So the Dalai Lama said, you know, religions aren't divided vertically. Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Taoism, they're not vertically, they're divided horizontally. There are people who are practicing their spiritual life, and they're pretty much all alike, no matter what you call them. or even if you don't call them anything, even if there's none of the above, I don't want to be any in any of your clubs. People who are practicing a spiritual life are pretty much all the same, and people who aren't practicing a spiritual life are pretty much all the same, regardless of what they call themselves. And plenty of them call themselves Buddhists or Hindus or Christians or Muslims or whatever, not practicing their spiritual life at all, just hassling with each other, when they're not killing each other, just hassling with each other. So, how did I get off on that? What am I talking about?
Shari Pusher asked if any son of a good lineage.
So a member of a good lineage is somebody who's practicing their spirituality. They've joined the worldwide club of people trying to be better people. Okay? People who are trying to put the principles that all the traditions teach into practice in their lives. And especially in their relationships with others. And especially in their relationships with people of other religions. So that's the good family. Joining the family of people who are trying to live according to the principles of a spiritual life. Of love, of compassion, of humility, of forgiveness, of, you know, those kinds of virtues. So he's like, how does a person like that, you know, who's joined that club, who's joined the big club of people who are trying to practice their religion, how do I understand the way things are? So he pops the question. All right. Let's start our text now. Class 2. Having been so addressed, the realized being, Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, replied to the venerable Shariputra like this. Shariputra, this is what any son or daughter, okay? So the first thing he does is get this guy like gender correct, okay? No, Shariputra, how does a son of a, you know, blah, blah, blah. Very interesting. This is an ancient text. And the answer says, doesn't matter, male or female, son or daughter. This is what any, you know, kula putra, putra means son, va kula duhita, or a daughter of a noble family, you know, the family of spiritual practitioners. This is what any son or daughter of a good lineage who wanted to engage in the practice of the profound, the perfection of wisdom, would need to observe. He or she would see. And the verbs are important in this text. This verb is this verb comes from the root pashyati, which means to sort of see both. It has the two connotations that we have for that verb. See, you know, visually, but also I see, you know, I get it. Intellectually, I get it. When we say I get it, I see, we mean in my mind, I've worked it out. Intellectually, I understand it. So this is the part of the text that when they decode it and try to find where the next path begins, they say it's here. This is now moved to a kind of a implicit description of what they call a path of preparation. Preparation. So we move from the path of accumulation, accumulating the momentum that comes only from a kind of renunciation. I'm tired of futilely beating my head against the wall, and I'm going to try a different way. Okay, path of accumulation. Then he said, then with this response, you know, Avalokiteshvara starts us out according to the commentaries, right? The hidden meaning of the verse, of the term, of the text, starts us out on the path of what they call preparation. Pra-yoga in Sanskrit, pra-yoga. So it's yoga. Pra means getting ready. So it's kind of getting ready for the real yoga, getting ready for the real show. The third path is the real show, in a way, okay? I'll just tell you now. So what's the path of preparation? One sort of simple way of kind of talking about it is that you see deeper and deeper. You see deeper and deeper into the realities of things. And it's not just seeing or, you know, being able to, you know, it is intellectual. I see. But it's also beginning to change you. See, it's deep. So I thought for this part, for the path of preparation, we'd go to a different text, actually. Because in the Yoga Sutra, there's a nice little kind of summary of the sorts of things that you would, you know, that you would be concentrating on in this next sort of stage of your spiritual career. First stage of the spiritual career is you've got that kind of renunciation and you start to get serious about a spiritual life. Because you've freed up the time, the energy, the wherewithal to really start concentrating on a spiritual life instead of concentrating on making money and having better relationships, instead of concentrating on the externals, you start concentrating on the internals. Then the second path, which begins at this point in the text, according to the commentators, path of preparation. And in the Yoga Sutra, which is a text about the same age as this text, Heart Sutra, about the same date, 2,000 years ago or so, there's a nice summary of, I think, 5 kinds of virtues that you would be concentrating on the path of preparation. The first one in Sanskrit is Shraddha. Shraddha means confidence, faith. Okay? Sometimes they call it faith, translated. But it means that because you've started a serious spiritual practice with the path of what? Accumulation. Because you've started a serious practice, because you've invested now some real time and energy, so you've gotten your back behind it a little bit, you start to see results. You start to see, wait, I'm waking up happier in the morning. You know what I mean? I'm waking up looking forward to the day instead of dreading it. You ever been through periods where you are in bed and consciousness comes and you go, oh shit, another day. Oh my God, right? And because you've worked on the hard disk a little bit, that attitude starts to change. Your subjective viewpoint starts to change. You start looking forward to your life. You start being happier, in other words. And then Shraddha, you see, then you get some faith in the practice. And probably not until, okay? Probably not until. So there's going to be a little bit of lag time, okay? There's going to be a little bit of lag time between the time that you actually give it a go and the time that you start to see some obvious results, okay? And that's the time where you need Shraddha in the different kind of sense, faith. So here's how, in my experience, here's how you get that kind of faith. You hear stuff like this, you come to a class like this, come to a yoga studio, come to a spiritual teaching of some sort, and you say, well, that sounds pretty good. You see, maybe I'll give that a go. Generally speaking, people who really are serious about that, instead of just, kind of dabblers, people who are like go into the water, into the ocean or something like that, and they put their foot in like this a little bit, and go, ooh, 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 this is tingly, ooh. People who just jump in are people who are desperate, who have a certain kind of desperation, good desperation. I call it Thelma and Louise desperation, like that movie at the end of the movie. Everyone seen that movie? Yeah. And, they're taking it on the lam, right? They're chased by all these cops and everything, and they run out of, they have that cool Thunderbird convertible, and they run out of road at the Grand Canyon or something, I think, right? And so the only thing in front of them is this chasm. And they look in their rearview mirror, and they see all of these cop lights behind them, Hundreds of them they were being followed by at this point. Okay, so they know what's behind them. And we kind of, we know what's behind us in life. At a certain point, you look behind you and go, well, it's all going to be pretty much that same ahead if I, go back. The future's going to be pretty much like the past unless I do some changes, make some changes. But I don't know that making the changes will really work. Don't know, because you never tried it. You see? Never tried it. So what do they do? What did Thelma and Louise do? They floor the freaking Thunderbird. They floor the accelerator, and they just go for it. And they kind of like go off the, you know, off the edge of the canyon. Then what happens? Anybody know? They fall to their deaths and crash it. Is that what happens? This is all in the movie, okay? This is just a movie. They freeze frame it and run the credits. Okay? They're fine. They'll be fine. But you got to take the risk, you know? You don't know what's ahead for sure. But you know what's behind. And it's just cop cars. It's just trouble. Continuing to live a life of ignorance, of selfishness, of non-discipline, it's going to bring you the same results it's always brought you. This is a definition of insanity, you know, of just continuing to do the same thing over and over again in the hope that it'll bring a different result than the result it's always brought in the past. And that's the leap of faith, you know. Kierkegaard called it a leap of faith. And there's, I don't think there's any way around that, you know. At a certain point in one's, you know, trajectory, spiritual trajectory, you just got to take a leap of faith and just say, well, I know all the stuff that hasn't worked out, you know. I know all the kinds of things I tried that didn't bring the kind of happiness and contentment and satisfaction in life that I've, you know, been trying to get my whole life. I know what hasn't worked. And I don't know actually if this is going to work, but it sounds like maybe it could if I tried it. So you give it a go. Shraddha. In that sense, you have, you know, on faith. And then the shraddha in the second sense, the confidence that you see once you have given it a go. For a while, okay? You know, it's not a long time relative to life, you know? 6 months, maybe? 3 to 6 months to start to see some real obvious changes in your psyche, okay? Which will also mean changes in your understanding of your life, okay? Change you, change the world. And you start to see changes in both ways. Not because the world has changed out there, but because you've changed you, and then the world that you perceive has changed also. See? And you'll start to see that people are friendlier, but life is easier, you know, happier, a little happier and like that. You start to see, and then you go, well, if a little bit of effort has brought about this kind of result, what if I really got busy, you know? And that's the path of preparation. Then you say, okay, let's see what this sucker can really do. You know, let's put it into fifth and open it up a little bit. Okay, that's right. Then virya. Virya means that kind of what I just was saying. Get busy. Joyful effort. Working hard for stuff that will really pay off for you. We all know how to work hard, okay? We all know how to work hard. But most of us are working hardest for things that really won't pay off in the long run. Okay? You'll lose it all in one way or another. It'll change, it'll break, you'll die, she'll die, you know. So you work hard on changing you. Okay? Not to change the world. We work hard on changing the world. Virya. That comes from shraddha, you see. Comes from that faith of knowing that with a little bit of effort, I've already seen results. I've seen results in my own life. I've seen results in my own head. So let's now exert even more effort. And then they always say joyfully, happily. So it's not a spiritual practice to drag your weary ass into a yoga studio, unhappy, and practice yoga or go to a spiritual teacher, I got to do this. Disgruntled the whole time. Sometimes people ask me, like, well, how do I find a good teacher, or, you know, Dharma teacher or a good yoga teacher? I've been to yoga classes where the yoga, and I've been to Dharma classes too, this, for that matter, where the teacher is just unhappy the whole time. They're just like kind of bummed out and, you know, pissed off, and you know, like that. It hasn't worked for them, you see? Yoga didn't work for them. The spiritual life didn't work for them. So what have they got really to teach you? You know what I mean? It should be making you happier. A happier person. And then with virya, then you go, well, and so happily I'm going to work my ass off. Happily. Because what else is there to do? Somebody emailed me recently and said, like, well, what do I do about people who come to me and say, I'm so discouraged, you know? I tried meditating for 2 weeks. And I got really discouraged because I can't really concentrate now any better than I could before. And, you know, I tried being nice to that person 3 times when I saw that person, and they're still not nice back to me. You know, well, we all get discouraged like this, you see. We all get discouraged. But somebody who's gotten up to this stage in their spiritual trajectory knows, well, what else is there worth doing? When you get discouraged, well, what else should I do? Go back to the old life? See? There's no going back kind of at this point. You realize that, you know, that Thelma and Louise thing's for real. That the only way is forward. And so you get virya, you know, in another sense. You get determination. So like, what the hell? I don't care if it, you know, I don't care if the person that I've been trying to be nice with for the last 6 months is still not being nice to me. I don't care. See, what else is there to do but to continue, you know? Sooner or later, things will change. You know, either I won't perceive them to be not nice to me, or they will be nice to me. You see what I mean? Doesn't matter. Either way, something's going to shift if you continue. If you continue. So you just keep going for it. You go for it. So then the next one is smriti. Smriti means like you remember what it is that you're doing with your life. Smriti means literally remembering. You recall over and over and over again, especially when the going gets rough. You recall over and over and over again, what this is what I'm doing with my life. I've made the pivot. I've made the turn. And I'm not going back. This is what I do. Remembering. It's like having a mental, you know, it's like a mental version of tying a string around your finger. I remember what I'm supposed to be doing with my life. And you don't go like for long periods of time spacing out on that. Which, if you're like me, you've had periods like that. Where, you know, it's like, oh yeah, that meditation thing sounds good. And I'll, you know, try to be nice. And, you know, I'll try to get some wisdom. And then like stuff takes over. You know, you get busy, you get, you know, diverted. And then like 2-3 weeks go by and go, I was supposed to be meditating. You know, you wake up again. Somebody who's got this smriti is not forgetting for long periods of time like that. They're on it mentally. They remember all the time. And more or less all the time, right? And especially when it gets difficult. Especially when it doesn't seem to be working. You see, this is a really important thing for you know. Many, I know many of you in this room, and you know, you've been coming to these things for a while now. And if you're like just about everyone else that I know, including myself, you will get discouraged. You'll go, well, what the hell? You know, I've been trying to practice for the last couple of years, and I still have money problems. For example, you see. I still am. Oh, and wait, I just got sick. You know, right? My health just went or something like that. This isn't working. And so, you know, a couple of pieces of advice on this, you know, from personal experience. One of them I already mentioned. Well, what the hell else are you going to do? You see, you got a better plan? You got a better plan for avoiding sickness, old age, suffering, you know, money problems, people being nasty to you? You got a better plan than a spiritual life? And if so, well, go ahead and implement it. See how it works out for you. The old plans, the other plans don't work. There is no plan B here. It's only plan A. Okay, so that's one way to keep going, right? To keep, when you're discouraged, the other way is to take everything as a teaching. to take every so-called problem as an opportunity to learn something from it. And here's one thing that you can learn right away. What did you think? That you somehow, because you've been practicing for a couple months, were going to be permanently immune from suffering in life? You're just like everyone else. Okay? This is life. This is samsara. Everyone suffers. Everyone has problems. Your advantage is that you should know how to deal with problems. Not that you shouldn't have them. Okay? That's unrealistic, to say the least. You see? So that's a really important teaching. When you have problems as a practitioner, when you have problems, don't get discouraged. Go, oh, this is a reminder. You see? I'm just like everyone else. I will have problems, but I am different in one way. What's that? Well, I have practice. I know what I'm supposed to do when I have problems. I know what I'm supposed to do. So now do it. See, you have the armaments. You have the weaponry. Most people don't. They are just victims of the same problems that we all have. Health problems, money problems, relationship problems. Same problems, but they have no training. They don't know what to do. They're just victims. They're just total victims over and over again. So that's another very important lesson, is that you're not different from other people, but you don't have to be a victim. You can change a problem into an opportunity. Smriti, that means you remember this, okay? You remember what it is that you've learned when life comes and smacks you upside the head. Which it will. It will. Okay? Don't think this is the purpose of a spiritual life is to never have problems. This will cause you great disillusionment if that's what you think the spiritual life is. That now that I'm a serious spiritual practitioner, nothing will ever go wrong for me. Nothing unexpected will ever happen. See? Setting yourself up for major disillusionment. Okay? Nobody promised you this. At least I didn't. Okay? Nobody promised that if you start trying to live a better life, that you will never have any problems anymore. What we can promise is that you'll know how to deal with them better. You'll know how to surf the waves instead of just being smashed by them. And that's what we can offer, okay? And smriti means you remember. Oh yeah, I have training on what happens when things go wrong, unexpected things happen to me. See? Then the next one is samadhi. Samadhi. Samadhi means, it's often translated as meditation. It's one of the, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 Sanskrit words that could possibly be translated as meditation. Sanskrit's got a very large vocabulary for what we have about one word for. Maybe two, contemplation, you know. So, and each one of them sort of has their own technical meaning, but unfortunately the technical meanings can change from text to text. So you can't really, kind of standardize any of the meanings for any of these words. Samadhi in general, okay, sort of literally, means integration. To bring together. Sum in Sanskrit is a prefix that means together, and the adi, the d part, means to put our place, to place things together, to get it together. How's that? So samadhi, a person who's practicing samadhi has gotten it a little bit together. They've gotten their shit together. Okay. And they're not just capsized by every wave. You see what I mean? They're chilled out. How's that? They're chilled out. Instead of like panicking and freaking out about stuff left and right, they've got a chilled out attitude about life. Okay? Samadhi. And then prajna. The last one is prajna. What does prajna mean? Wisdom. They're starting to get deeper and deeper intellectual understandings of how things work and how they don't work. So that's what This is what the first thing Avalokiteshvara says to Shariputra is, you know, you should start to see that the five groups are empty of any true nature. So what are the five groups? The five groups, the aggregate, sometimes translated as aggregates, skandhas in Sanskrit. The five aggregates or groupings are the five parts of me. The five parts that make me up. And not just me, you also. First one is form. Form. Rupa. The reason I'm telling you that is because of the next thing that Avalokiteshvara says is very, very famous. And it's all about rupa. And shunyata. Rupa. Rupa means form. It means your physical form. It means your body. But it means all form in your world also. Okay? It means all appearances. Anything that has form is your form. Okay? There's no world out there that has form. There's a world that you interact with that has form. Okay? So that's what it means, all appearances. Okay? So in other words, they're regarded as you. Everything that is tangible in your world is regarded as you. Because you're changed by it, of course. Right? There isn't any you who then interacts with tangible things. You see what I mean? You and tangible things exist interdependently. We are as much the world around us as the world around us is us. You see what I mean? Yeah. Change you, change the world, change you. In interdependence. So rupa means not just your physical body, isolated from all other physical things. Okay? It means tangible things in general. That's the first one. So that's the physical. That's the physical aspect of ourselves. The material physical aspect of ourselves. And then there's sort of four parts to the mental aspect of ourselves. You know, nowadays our neuroscientists are moving closer and closer. Some of them, I think, have already sort of gotten there to the idea that, and it's only an idea, that everything can be reduced to physical matter. There are no, like, truly mental things that aren't just, you know, reducible to some kind of brain function, right? If there is no mind, there's only a brain. This is the opposite of a spiritual life. Okay? That reductive attitude that the only things that exist are physical is the opposite of a spiritual life. Spirit means that there's something other than just physical things. Okay? And in this presentation of who we are, there are four aspects of our mental being. Our mental being, not our physical being. Not just the neurons firing. But four kinds of things. I think there are also, Dr. Yona, maybe we should talk about this. I think that some neuroscientists are backing away from this kind of quickly now, too. It's a debate, right? Is there a ghost in the machine, right? Or is it just a machine? Anyway, the spiritual life has always assumed the ghost. Yeah. And we'll continue. I mean, otherwise there won't be a spiritual life. See? The belief that the only things that exist are physical is the opposite of a spiritual life. It's a materialist idea. So, four parts to the mental aspects of ourselves. There is the ability to discriminate. And the reason that they're called aggregates or groupings is because we have six different ways that we can discriminate things. We can discriminate things visually, can discriminate things different sounds, different smells, different touches. What am I missing?
Taste.
Huh? Different tastes and different thoughts. There is the feelings. So that's the third grouping, second of the mental grouping, feelings. So generally speaking, in the philosophy, Buddhist philosophy, they reduce the feelings that we have to three. It's just kind of three basic ones. Pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And, you know, that's kind of like cutting to the chase in a way, right? All feelings, you can say either pleasant, I'm having a pleasant feeling, no matter what I call it, unpleasant, or, you know, whatever. whatever feeling. Eh? Okay. Then there is, so how many did you get so far? Three. Consciousnesses. Consciousnesses. Each one of these is a heap, a grouping, an aggregate. So we have similarly six consciousnesses. We have visual consciousness. We are aware of what we see. We see, but we don't really see unless we are aware of what we see. You see what I mean? The eyeball, in a way, does not see. The eyeball doesn't see. The visual consciousness registers sights. I am aware of something. I am aware of seeing something. And the same with the other five physical senses. And then, you know, they always throw in the sixth. There are six senses in Indian philosophy. The mental sense. So, you know, we have a consciousness of what we are conscious of mentally. You see what I mean? Mental consciousness too. So we have visual consciousness, audio consciousness, but we also have a consciousness of what we're thinking about. Consciousness of consciousness, you could say. Like that. So those are the, and then the last group is called the sanskaras. And this is always difficult because there are so many things that they throw into this grouping. So, bottom line, and we don't really have to go into it, it's not important for our purposes, it's our proclivities, our mental proclivities, our predispositions, habits, you know, like that. Often regarded as karmic. So here, samskara and vasana would be very closely related, synonyms almost. Vasana, for those of you who haven't, you know, been to other teachings, a vasana in Sanskrit is compared to the lingering smell of a woman's perfume after the woman has left the room. And we all have these vasanas. That is to say, impressions, mental impressions of what we've said, done, or thought. Okay? After we've said, done, and thought it. There's something lingers. You know what I mean? You could maybe call them memories, in a way. But also assuming subconscious and unconscious memory. If something lingers. So he says, he or she would see that the five groups are empty of any true nature. So here's what I really wanted to talk about, and then we got to get to the next and last part of the sutra before we quit, because it's really important. What I wanted to talk about here is what do they mean by the emptiness of me? Okay, never mind the five skandhas. He's saying five skandhas. Think about the emptiness of the five skandhas, and then he goes into a long, long discussion about that, or sort of long. This actually is sometimes known as the concise answer. You know, Shariputra's got a question. Avalokiteshvara says, here it is, boom. And then the sort of bulk of the sutra following is called the long answer. It kind of expands it out. What he's really saying here is, Shariputra, think about how you say your name to yourself are empty. The emptiness of the person. So, here's how this goes, because this will be your exercise connected to this class. So I'll explain it a little bit, if you wanted to do it. This is a really good one. And it's one that people have a lot of resistance to. Why? Because you say your name to yourself doesn't want to be seen as a phantom. We've got a huge investment in thinking that there's a self that's in there somewhere that's impossible. So the meditation is on the impossibility of there being the kind of self that we think we have. So the first part of this meditation is to get in touch with, well, what kind of self is that? And by the way, this I found to be much of this ancient teaching, you know, in Buddhist philosophy has been confirmed by neuroscience. There's no HQ in there. There's no in fact, they call it the pearl theory. Pearl? Like inside the shell, there should be a pearl. That'd be me. The pearl of me in there. They've given up trying to find it. They tried. They did their best with all their gadgetry and all of that. There's no self in there that's controlling everything else. No HQ self. The Buddhists call this a master self, you know, who's the master of all, you know, of the spaceship me. You know, I call it the Captain Kirk self, you know, who's master of the sort of located up there on the deck of the spaceship Enterprise, spaceship me, who's just giving commands all day, you know, raise right arm and, you know, walk to bathroom and, you know, there's nobody like that. There's no self like that. We are empty of having a master self like that. And the proof of it is unfortunately obvious to us every day. We have unwanted things happen to us during the course of the day. You see? Not in charge of our lives. Stuff, you know that expression, stuff happens? Stuff that we didn't control, that we can't control. The traffic on Punt Road, you know, is snarled. Well, no, I'm going to change that, you know. If there was a master self in there, you would never have traffic on Punt Road if you didn't want it. You just like, you know. Did you ever see that movie, that TV show that you're probably in reruns now, I Dream of Jeannie? Where she just like shakes her head like this with a ponytail and like Shazam, then everything changes, you see? If there was a master self like that, we would just like kind of be doing Punt Road traffic, you know. And boom, go. We're deceived about it because oftentimes, you know, it seems to work, you see. I give a command, raise right arm, like mindlessly, you know. And look, I can do it. You suppose there will come a day where, you know, Captain Kirk in there says, raise right arm, and that won't happen? What if I broke my arm? Did I command my arm to break? See, first of all. So, you know, it was an accident. Means it wasn't in my control. So I break my arm, and then Captain Kirk goes, raise right arm. And the arm's, you know, is in a cast and a sling. Doesn't raise. See, if there was a Captain Kirk self like that, you wouldn't have that problem. You wouldn't have that experience, let alone the more obvious and repeated daily experiences of not getting your way in life. Okay? There's no self that is unchanging. So, you know, the way to really do this experiment is first of all to get in touch with the kind of self you think you have. And we all think we have a Captain Kirk self, master self, HQ self. And we all think that there's an unchanging self in there. It's the witness. Sometimes they call it the witness self. The self that just watches you go through life without changing. Watches the you going through life, which is a constant state of change, right? From the time you're, you know, born to the time that you die. Constantly changing. But there's some self in there that just witnesses it. Isn't there a sense that we have like that? When we say, when I was three... So, who's the I that was three that's the same as the I that's now? Is it a physical you? Is your body now the same as your body when it was three? Yes or no? Come on. Every part of your physicality has changed dramatically, right? You've got a whole new cellular structure. Everything about your body's changed. What about your mind? Is your mind the same as it was when you were 3 years old? So if there is no continuous physical part of you and no continuous mental part of you, who's the you that is unchanging? This is the, I call this the find Wally from hell. I went to the dentist just yesterday actually, and he went down there and she got a big find Wally thing up there. And you know those find Wally things where you know. It's this little guy with a striped scarf and glasses that's hidden within a huge crowd of people. And, you know, you're supposed to kind of like spend hours trying to find, you know, where Wally is. Kids are able to do this very quickly, apparently. This is what I learned this at the dentist's office. that children, and the younger you are, the better you are at finding Wally. You tell me why. Why are kids able to find Wally? And I've been to that dentist several times now, and I finally just say, just tell me. Sick of looking for Wally, you know. Okay. Trying to find an unchanging self is like trying to find Wally, only it's from hell because he ain't there. See, Wally in real life in the Find Wally games is there somewhere. You got to, you know, take years to find him sometimes, but he's there. Once, you know, there's no Wally like that. There's no unchanging self. You go looking for it and you'll never find it. Okay? No unchanging self, no master self, no self that's independent. That's kind of a master self, independent. Sometimes this is the language that they use, means a self that is independent of the mind and body. In other words, a self that has a mind or body, but isn't the mind and body. Okay? I have a body. We say this, right? I have a body, or I have a mind. Right? Well, who's the I that has the body and mind? Is there a separable I from the body and mind? And that's impossible, too. If that were the case, then you could be in Brisbane right now while your body and mind sat here in the chair in Melbourne. Right? No, theoretically. You could be separable. You put all your body and mind over in one corner, and then there'd be you over here. There's one obviously huge problem with that idea. Who would be thinking of a mind, your mind, separable from the... Who would be thinking about your mind if it were separable from your mind? See what I mean? If you were separable from your mind, who would be thinking, I am separable from my mind? Be a different mind? You see, it would have to be a different mind, right? Different mind from your mind. It's a problem, right? It's a huge problem. No unchanging self, no independent self. Which one am I forgetting?
Unitary.
No unitary self. Unitary means one. When you think of you, the way to think of you, the way to kind of get in touch with this is to just like say your name to yourself. Who? What does that refer to? What does that name refer to? What thing does that refer to? Entity does that refer to? And well, it refers to an unchanging thing, to an independent thing, a master self, and it refers to a one self, okay? When you say your name to yourself, you're not talking about a whole bunch of different people, are you? Unless you're kind of crazy. Unless you've got multiple personality disorder of a kind of a serious nature. You know, when we say our names to ourselves, we're referring to one thing, right? Where's that one thing? Where's the one self? So then, this is the classic example of this, the classic meditation is, am I one thing or many things? Am I, when I say my name to myself, am I one thing or am I many things? I said, well, I'm one thing. So what? Are you the same as your body or different, body and mind? Or are you different from your body and mind? And, you know, well, either way you lose, okay? If you are different from your body and mind, you've got this big problem of, like, you know, you being separable from your physical and mental parts, which is kind of impossible. You'd be in Brisbane, you could be, you know, your body and mind could be in Melbourne. You would be able to think about your mind with a mind different than your mind if you were separable from your mind. Okay? So no. I'm the same as my parts. I'm the same as my body and mind. Right? And we do this too, right? We identify with our bodies and minds. If I ask you how old you are and you give me a number, you've identified with your body. I am, you know, 60 years old. I am, right? And if you identify with your feelings, you've identified with your mind. I am happy. I am sad. I am depressed. I am, right? You identify with your mind. So we do this. But could you identify with your body and mind and still be a unitary you? Is your body one thing or many things? Say you're identified with your body, okay? I am my body. Is it one thing or many things? Is this body singular or plural? Which one? Does it have parts? How many parts? A whole bunch? heaps of parts, right? Yeah. So how could there be oneness, unitariness, in something that just has multiple parts? What about your mind? Does it have parts? Is it one thing or many things? You have feelings, different kinds. And is it changing all the time? Feeling, you know, different kinds? Right? So where's the one thing that's identified with body and mind that are both plural? You see? If you're the same as your body and mind, you can't be one thing. It's a phantom. Okay? The unitary, unchanging, independent master self is an illusion. It exists, it does not exist independently, okay? And in that sense, it's an illusion. It does exist dependently, just like everything else does, okay? The self, so, you know, I always tease audiences, you know, and say like, okay, you know, you walked in with a self and now I take it away from you and now you feel like you want your money back or something. You do have a self, of course, but not the self you thought you had. It's not the independent, unchanging, unitary master self. The self exists as an idea of the self. It exists dependently on you thinking about it. Thinking about you, in other words. See? The concept of you, depend on you thinking about you. Okay? And there's no you that thinks about you without a you you know what I mean? Okay? So it exists in the same way that everything else does, interdependently. The idea of you, the concept of you, exists dependently on you thinking about the concept of you. But the you that thinks about the concept of you exists dependently on the concept of you. And that's how you exist. That's how everything exists. Okay? So that's something to put in your pipe and smoke for a while. Yeah. Probably a hookah. Make it last for a long time. All right, I got 10 minutes to do the most important part of the Heart Sutra. Ready? Let's see if I can do it. Rupam shunyata, shunyataiva rupam. Rupa na pratak shunyata, shunyataya na pratak rupam. You don't even have to know Sanskrit to know what this says, okay? Can you hear it? That which takes form is emptiness. Rupam shunyata. And emptiness is truly that which just takes form. Shunyataiva rupam. Rupam na pratak. It's not different from shunyata. Form is not different from shunyata. Rupam na pratak shunyata. And shunyataya na pratak rupam. Yad rupam sa shunyata. Ya shunyata tad rupam. That which takes form, rupa, that which takes form is emptiness. And there's been a lot of controversy in the commentarial tradition about that verb. It is emptiness. That which takes form is emptiness. And emptiness truly is that which takes form. I mean, you know, it's pretty clear in the Sanskrit. They're not mincing words. It is the same. It is. The verb means that they are the same. Sort of. Okay? We'll have to talk about that. That which takes form is emptiness. And emptiness truly is that which takes form. Emptiness is not different from that which takes form. And with that which takes form is not different from emptiness. So we can stop there. This is sometimes known as the Heart of the Heart Sutra. This formulation. These four, sometimes they call it the four profundities. Okay? So it's another possible, you know, identifiable place where you can say this is the Heart of the Heart Sutra. This is the summary of the teaching of wisdom in the Heart Sutra. So what is it? Form is emptiness. In other words, form exists but is empty of existing in any other way than interdependently. Okay? All form, all tangible form. Everything exists interdependently. So form is emptiness in the sense that the way it exists, which is interdependently, means that it's empty of existing, come on, independently. form is emptiness. And emptiness is form. So this means that there is no emptiness without form. There's no emptiness, there's no absence of an independently existing form, like a cup, unless what? There's a dependently, interdependently existing cup. The interdependently existing cup is empty of being independently existing. Okay? And there's no emptiness of an independently existing cup unless there is what? An interdependently existing cup. Is it too much in the afternoon? The biorhythm's too low here now? There's no emptiness without form. There's no form that isn't empty. There's nothing that exists. I mean, you know, they're just taking form because this is something we can get our heads around really easily. Okay? Because form, you know, appearances. You know, you can see it. You can hear it. You can feel it. It's tangible. There's no form that exists in any other way than interdependently. It is empty. Okay? There is nothing tangible that exists in any other way than interdependently with lots of different things. Okay? We'll go into more about interdependence next class. And there's no emptiness of an interdependently existing object unless there's an interdependently existing object. The emptiness of something that does exist interdependently is its absence of existing independently. But there has to be something that exists interdependently to have that absence. Okay? Glazing over. The eyes are glazing over. The steam's coming out the ears and all like that. And then the third and fourth one. Emptiness is not different from that which takes form. Emptiness is not different from that which takes form. So there's no free-floating emptiness that could exist without form. There's no free-floating emptiness absence of an independent existing cup that exists apart from an interdependently existing cup. Okay? And vice versa. And there's no interdependently existing cup that exists independently of its emptiness. Okay? So the last two, emptiness is not different from that which takes form. And that which takes form is not different from emptiness, just underscores the fact that these are two ways of looking at the same thing. In the technical commentaries, they say it is the same entity. The emptiness of the cup and the cup are the same entity, but we can talk about them in two different ways. It's like saying, there's fire, and there's something hot and burning. Okay? Is it the same thing that we're talking about? Yeah. But we can conceptualize it differently because we have different language, different names for it, right? When you say fire and you think fire, you think something slightly different than when you say hot and burning. But they're referring to the same thing. When you say water, and you say wet and flowing, you're referring to the same entity, the same substance. But you're thinking about it, you're conceptualizing it from two different ways, slightly different ways. See what I mean? To say that this thing is absent, empty, of existing independently, all by itself, and to say that it does exist interdependently is referring to the same thing, but just talking about it from two different angles. Okay? One negative and one positive, you could say. Something is not there, but something is there. Both. something is not there. A permanent, unchanging, independently existing cup is not there. But there is something there. What? A changing, impermanent, dependently existing cup. Okay? Yeah. This is you could cut this out and put it on your refrigerator. This is the Heart Sutra. Those four kind of statements are the essence of the Heart Sutra. The heart of the Heart Sutra. Things exist, but they do not exist independently. And emptiness, the absence of independently existing things, doesn't exist without interdependently existing things. No free-floating emptiness either. So here's another way of putting it, okay? I know this is hard, okay? And so we just crunch for another 5 minutes and we'll go get some lattes. Emptiness and form, okay? Form, how things appear, themselves exist interdependently. Okay? There's no emptiness without form, and there's no form without emptiness. That's interdependence, okay? So although they refer to slightly different concepts, they refer to the same entity. They refer to the same thing. And the two sides of them, the two perspectives on them, cannot exist without the other. There is no interdependently existing cup because it is empty of existing independently. There is an interdependently existing cup because it exists empty of independence. And the emptiness of the cup exists because there's an interdependent cup. Two ways of talking about the same thing. This causes a lot of consternation among people and has for centuries, okay? Don't worry. If your face is like this, like I see some people's faces are like this, just Botox, okay? Just relax. Okay? It really isn't that hard to get intellectually. The only reason it's hard is because there's so much resistance to it. Because our ignorance is very deeply seated. We have not thought about this in this way pretty much our whole lives. And by the way, in 2 minutes, we'll stop thinking about this. And we'll go to get our independently existing latte at our independently existing cafe in our independently existing little self in there, you know. Oh, it's really sad, you know. I've spent lots and lots of time translating Sanskrit texts like this and trying to figure it out, and, you know, like hours and hours translating it, you know, like this. And, oh, yeah, okay, it's empty. I get it. It's empty. As soon as you stop, as soon as you, like, get up and, you know, get a cup of tea or something like that, it just comes flying. Like it never happened in a way. You see? So that's why that analogy last night I was talking about picking at the loose thread of the jumper. You know, so we have our little two-hour session of jumper thread picking. And that, you know, that's the best we can do. That's what we do. We try to understand that we are deluded about ourselves and about the world. that the world cannot exist the way we think it does. And we can't exist the way we ordinarily think it does. And so you get a little, you know, the thread gets a little looser every time you do it. And, you know, little by little by little, we start to try to get some more realization of that instead of just, you know, sort of temporary intellectual grasping of the concept. Things exist, but they do not exist the way we think they exist. They exist dependently or interdependently. They do not exist independently, and we exist in that same way. We exist. We do. There's a self. But the self is not an independently existing self. It exists dependently, interdependently, on kind of a lot of other things, actually. You know, you could say on everything. it exists interdependently with everything and everybody. Okay? Alright. So here's the exercise. Exercise for class two. I won't read it here. You can read it yourself. It's just to do that little contemplation or meditation over and over and over again. Of like trying to find Wally. Where's Wally? Where's that self that you think exists that has never existed? Okay? Complete illusion. But that we thoroughly believe in. Okay? So, like I said, there's resistance. Many people will not do this exercise. I tell you that right now. Not just because you don't do it, you know, I'm not doing any of the exercises, but because this one there's so much resistance to. The non-existent self will try to defend itself. The illusion will try to defend itself. And there's all kinds of ways it does this. I'm not going to do an exercise where I have to think about how I don't exist. I'm not even going to listen to this guy talk anymore. I'm thinking about my latte. When's he going to be done? He said it was going to be done at 2:30. You know, all kinds of ways. Well, I'll just tell you one quick story, and then we go. I used to go, I had the good fortune of going to hear the Dalai Lama many times in my life. I think I've maybe heard him live, I think about 10, 12 times. And, you know, the Dalai Lama gives all different kinds of teachings. He gives very, very sort of general teachings to the general public, which is all about, you know, be nice, okay? Just be nice. That's the basic teaching. Be kind, be nice. And then he does teachings like on this stuff, you know, puts it into fifth gear. I've been to teachings like on this kind of thing, you know, this not. I actually have been to a teaching on the Heart Sutra by the Dalai Lama, as well as other kinds of teachings of this sort of caliber. And when I went to those kind of teachings regularly, I would just fall asleep. Almost as soon as he started talking, didn't matter how much sleep I had the night before, the circumstances were not like overheated room or anything like that. It was just like some kind of demon would come and sprinkle slumber, you know, juice on me. And I tried all kinds of things. You know, as soon as he would talk about stuff like this, it was just like, And so I tried, like, okay, I'll just go to sleep during the Tibetan parts. And then I'll wake up for the English translations. So I tried to take, like, little mini cat naps, and as soon as the translator started, you know. I tried everything. This was the imaginary self who was under attack going, let's shut down here. Don't listen. Don't pay attention. Let's shut this. See, it does defend itself. It will definitely defend itself. It's kind of an interesting thing that an illusion can defend itself. Something that's not even there can put up such resistance. All right, let's take a break. That's a very good question, Malcolm, and I think, if you don't mind, we'll just spend another 5 minutes on it. Because, no, it's a really important question. After years of thinking about this and interacting with people who have very low self-esteem, and many of us do, increasingly in our cultures have depression problems and low self-esteem. In other words, there's not enough ego. Or you could say it's the wrong kind of ego.
Is that low self-esteem in a Tibetan culture or
not? You know, it doesn't seem like it. It doesn't seem like when the Dalai Lama was first confronted with Westerners complaining about like low self-esteem, he couldn't quite grasp what they were talking about. Yeah. So I think there is cultural differences, and I think also that this is a modern phenomenon. Actually, it's modern and it's sort of non-traditional. Yeah, you know, and it's part, I think, part and parcel of the economy that we live under that you know, kind of encourages us to selfishness, encourages us to think about ourselves more and more and more all the time. I think that people with low self-esteem still, they do have an ego. They do have a self, but they've defined their self as somebody who has low self-esteem. That's the kind of me I am. See, there's still a kind of a unconscious, I think, almost entirely unconscious, need to feel special and like somebody. We all have that need to feel like really somebody special. But since they can't, for whatever reason, people, you know, and at different times, different people, or the same person at different times, since they can't find outlets for that in a positive way, I'm somebody special because of my talents or because of my work or because of my money or in whatever it is, then they find it in a negative way. I'm somebody special because I suffer. Not really. And I suffer more than you. I'm a depressed person. You're not a depressed person. I'm a depressed person. So it's, again, grasping to a self. So that's one way to answer your question. The other way to answer your question is to really struggle with true self-knowledge, to unmask the illusion. There has to be a strong sense of the illusion to unmask. You see, you have to have an ego to perform the egoectomy. And so if the ego isn't strong enough, then the ego has to be built up before the egoectomy begins. So in my understanding, and you know, this is probably an exaggeration and probably due to, you know, lack of ignorance, but to my understanding is that most forms of therapy, of psychological, psychiatrical therapy, are about building up the ego. And the spiritual life is the opposite. So if the person doesn't have the status, you know, Freud called it the state of ordinary unhappiness. If they don't have that kind of sort of state of ordinary unhappy, of a good, strong, healthy, unhappy ego, then the spiritual life can't really begin.
Really, Western tradition builds on form. Mm-hmm. Without that, there isn't a tradition.
Well, I mean, which tradition isn't built on form? What do you think?
Yeah, they all have form, but it comes back to this question of, I don't know, I've been in Tibet, I don't know how to contribute, but if there's no sense of depression there, there's no sense of lack,
well, depression, it's not that people don't suffer, but depression is a particular kind of suffering that requires a particular kind of understanding of the self. And there are different kinds of understandings of the self cross-culturally and over time. That's true. That has to be true. In traditional societies, it's my impression that there's much more of a there's much more of an idea of a self that's defined by its connections to groups than there is now. We have this much more atomistic understanding of the self. I'm all by myself, individual self. And that's kind of just a function of, you know, of historical forces in a way, cultural and historical forces that have broken down, you know, traditional communities and so forth. They've put us all in cities and, you know, living in our own little apartments and condos and houses and not interacting in the same kind, and not identifying in the same kind of way that we used to with smaller communities. But anyway, that's a complicated question. These texts are old; they're ancient, and they do assume that everyone, you know, back then also had some kind of grasping to a self, grasping to an ego, grasping to an illusion. But the kind of self that they were grasping to, the contours of the idea, the contours of the imaginary self, have undoubtedly changed over time and cross-culturally. Yeah. And possibly even between individuals in the same culture. The kind of self we think we have. Of course, but we are brought up to think of ourselves, in particular kinds of ways. And modern Western societies are, you know, we're brought up to think of ourselves as independent, free agents, you know, separable from others and so forth, yeah. Very strongly, actually.
And that everyone has the opportunity. I mean, the American dream idea is filtered into Australia, and so everybody's has the opportunity to make it big and to be, you know.
I could be anyone.
That's right.
Yeah, self-made man. And now in the internet era, I could be famous. And so, you know, if only I got the right YouTube video up, I could go viral. No, and there's versions of this in all of our lives. Your Facebook postings, how many thumbs up did I get? You know, am I famous enough? The self-worth has been increasingly given over to other people and their responses to us, our sense of self-worth. And that's just been exacerbated, I think, by the internet culture, and will be, continue. Which is, okay, just the last thing, okay? Here's my crackpot theory on that. My crackpot theory that springs from that observation is that's why depression's on the rise. The more narcissism, the more depression. The higher things go up, the lower they must come down. The emphasis on the ego, on the self, on self-aggrandizement, on self-image requires that there be a fall. Because it's never met, you see. Can never be sufficiently, met. I don't think so. But I just say crackpot in case somebody disagrees.